University of Iowa, we have a t-shirt that says University of Iowa, Idaho City, Ohio. And it's... And I think that it probably is pertinent in terms of the history of the Department of Energy and Atomic Energy Commission and where they've placed their sites. Marek spoke about an atomic bomb assembly facility in Burlington, Iowa. I'm going to speak about a facility on the Iowa State campus that was part of the Manhattan Project. There were probably half a million workers involved in the rush to develop atomic weapons in the United States during the Cold War. And they're scattered throughout places like Idaho City, Ohio, Paducah, Kentucky, Savannah River, Hanford. These are places that are scattered in relatively rural areas, Amarillo, Texas, around the country. The result there are a number of reasons how this came about. Some people say it was Admiral Watkins, the Department of Energy secretary, who, when he became secretary, he asked his underlings to talk to him about health and safety issues for Department of Energy workers, and was told that there were no health and safety issues because they all worked under need to know and under security constraints. So there were no health and safety issues because they, honest to goodness, didn't even exist in a legal sense. And he said, this can no longer be. And what eventually came out of this was the Energy Employee Occupational Injury Compensation Program Act, which is the act that Marek described that requires that these workers' health risks be ascertained, that they be made aware, educated as regards these health risks, that they be screened for health effects of these health risks, and that they be offered compensation through a related Department of Labor program. There are several agencies involved in this. The Department of Energy is responsible for identifying those workers, for providing medical screenings in a related act. The Department of Labor is responsible for assessing the work-relatedness of a health outcome and providing compensation. And NIOSH is responsible for determining exposure to radiation and probability of causation of a possible radiation-induced cancer under this act. These workers started working, for example, in Iowa in 1942, where they initially refined over 2 million pounds of uranium, much more than that, uranium ore, which was converted to uranium tetrafluoride, which was reduced to pure uranium for ingots that were used in the first nuclear reactors that developed the first plutonium for those atomic weapons. These workers worked in typical foundry conditions. These are 19th century conditions. This is a wood clapboard building that was the old women's gymnasium on the Iowa State campus. And these were very, very primitive conditions. In fact, they were using the equivalent of Starbucks coffee grinders to grind this uranium ore. And one of those workers was well known among the co-workers. He was referred to as the Green Hornet because when he woke up in the morning, there would be green plumes where he exhaled uranium from his nasal passages onto his pillow. They had very primitive work conditions. They operated under secrecy, and they did not know. There was certainly uncertainty regarding the health risks of this work. In this facility from 1942 till 1945 or so, as we said, they processed several million pounds of uranium. Subsequently, they converted those operations to purification of an even more hazardous radionuclide, thorium, which generates a radon-like substance called thoron, an inhalable alpha emitter with high hazards, a high degree of risk to the workers. The sorts of technology they use, this is from a formerly top-secret lab notebook of a Dr. Fisher. It says, revised hydrogen fluoride, thorium fluoride production bombs. These cylinders were used to add either sodium or magnesium to the uranium or thorium tetrafluoride, and this would create a potent exothermic reaction that says, heretofore we have been using a bomb closure described on page 63. This type of system has given us much trouble with leaks, and a new type has been devised. Those leaks were referred to as what the workers termed blowouts. A blowout is an exothermic reaction with such force that it would blow open those bombs, create fumes, and sometimes a tremendous amount of physical energy, to the extent that, fires were not uncommon. The next two slides are pictures of mimeographed lab bulletins that were made in the 1940s. This first one, you can't read it, but there's a text below. It says, "Hold it, boys, you have to show your identification papers." They would have frequent fires, and there were security issues, so those fires never really occurred. When people showed up, they had to try to keep all of this secret, and they couldn't describe what it was that caused the fire, etc. On one occasion, one of those blowouts was so forceful it moved the wall of that old woman's gymnasium 2 feet at the top where it was to meet with the roof. And the workers would go outside and write with 2x4s, they would write the wall again and then go back to work. This is another mimeograph sheet that says basically good secretaries are hard to keep, aren't they? This is a memo from a plant physician from 1957. It says, "In the 9 years before I started working for the Ames lab, 2 cases of sarcoidosis and 2 cases of borreliosis were diagnosed at the Ames laboratory. In the short time of 8 months that I've been with the laboratory, 2 new cases of sarcoidosis were detected. On top of that, in these last 8 months, 2 other cases of extensive lung abnormalities have been seen." Talking about a problem with interstitial lung diseases in these workers. This was one of the most highly exposed workforces, both to beryllium and to radionuclides in the Department of Energy history. Just a bit of history of how preceding Admiral Watkins and Yoigba, how the Department of Energy dealt with occupational health and safety issues. There was a Mr. Joe Harding, who was a Paducah gaseous diffusion plant or uranium enrichment worker, who died of cancer in 1990. And he told his wife as he was dying that he was certain that his death was the result of radionuclide exposures in his work. His wife arranged to have his bones exhumed and have radioactivity and uranium concentrations of his bones assayed, and he was found to be incredibly highly exposed to uranium. The Department of Energy, over a 15-year period, spent $1 million defending the state of Kentucky's workers' comp system against this claim for a workers' comp claim. And eventually, in 1997, the families were awarded a death claim of $12,500. So this is the history of how Department of Energy addressed occupational health and safety claims. Beryllium and borreliosis, these are problems that are relatively specific to high-tech aeronautics, high-tech electronics, and nuclear energy work. Beryllium is the lightest of metal with the densest of nuclei, and as it has dense nuclei, it reflects alpha emissions, neutron emissions, are reflected, dramatically increasing the fission energy released in a criticality event. Part of the EOICPA program and former worker protection programs now are screening workers involved in atomic weapons research and production for beryllium sensitization and beryllium lung disease. Beryllium lung disease is a bizarre lung disease in that it's not clearly a dose response risk. It's more of a genetic risk. Very similar to other immune-related phenomena, like a cat allergy, a hay fever, etc. Once you are sensitized, or if you have that propensity to become sensitized, it really takes minuscule doses to result in untoward health effects. One of our cases of CBD was a woman who worked less than 6 months, well after the heavy production of beryllium. Products. In the 1960s, she worked in an administration office for 6 months, found subsequently this last year to be sensitized and have beryllium lung disease. Another is a woman who just died a couple of months ago. She was the wife of one of the original researchers, 1950s-era researchers. That man, Dr. Norman Carlson, died of lung cancer with evidence of borreliosis. He was actually treated by Harriet Hardy in the 1950s for acute borreliosis, subsequently developed interstitial lung disease, found to be chronic beryllium disease, and then died with pulmonary fibrosis and lung cancer. His wife, who was only exposed to his clothing, came to see me. We found her to be highly sensitized, found her to have an unsuspected isolated pulmonary nodule, which turned out to be lung cancer. And when that lung cancer was removed, found to have diffuse granulomatous disease scattered throughout her lung. In that case, that disease took almost 45 years to manifest. So this is a disease that not only is it not dose related, but it can have an uncertain latency. In terms of the current federal response, we told you a bit about the Department of Energy's historical response to these workers' risks. The current response, this is from a memo that was leaked from the White House to folks in Congress last year. This is a memo from the White House Office of Management and Budget. It says, ESA Office of the Department of Labor is to be commended for identifying the potential for a large expansion of EOICBA benefits through the designation of special exposure cohorts. Special exposure cohorts are something that was described in this act that says that if there is knowledge of workers having been exposed to risks of radiation overexposure, and those risks cannot be quantified, then one cannot do the statistical process that NIOSH performs of dose reconstruction and probability of causation. Those workers should be considered special exposure cohorts, and if they have any of 22 radiation-induced cancers, they should be compensated automatically. So the White House responds, what we should do is require the White House clearance of special exposure cohort determination or address imbalance in the membership of a president's advisory board that rules on these special exposure cohort petitions, require expedited review by outside experts of SEC petitions. So looking at these first two points, it becomes quite clear that the White House is now interested not in a science-based policy, but in a fiscally-based policy, a policy to minimize acceptance of liability based on fiscal issues. This next couple of slides are just to give you some indication of what kinds of doses we're talking about. These are these DPM, P meter cubed, these are disintegrations per meter, disintegrations per minute per meter cubed in one day's work of a group of workers at the Ames lab in the 1950s. And you see numbers like 10,000 to 120,000 disintegrations per minute per meter cubed. So 100,000 DPM per meter cubed. We worked with a group of health physicists to determine what the significance of these exposures are. Excuse me, I just want to give you the bottom two lines here. The uranium workers in the 1940s, they received 50 rem per year exposure for these are 1 week's work of a uranium worker resulted in 0.5 sieverts. 1 day's work of a thorium worker could result in 2.5 sieverts. We're talking of incredible doses. We're talking doses tens of fold, orders of magnitude higher than the acceptable levels today. Orders of magnitude that indicate that 1 day's work of a thorium worker would result in probabilities of causation of greater than 50% for these workers. So we're actually arguing for these people several revisions of the EOICBA Act. One is that SEC petitions should not be based on fiscal issues. SECs for workers exposed to these sorts of concentrations should not require 250 days of work. And there are also issues in this law that give different rights to workers depending on their contracts. If they were DOE contracts, they are eligible for compensation. If they were atomic energy subcontractors, they're not. So there's atomic weapons employees that we're trying to also advocate for equivalent rights. Thank you very much.